Welcome to Vital Minds, a podcast series brought to you by the PA Foundation. Join us as we discuss some of the most vital issues in clinical care with top minds and skilled providers who face them every day, the PAs. We'll hear directly from PAs about disease diagnosis and treatment, patient interactions, and the critical care this profession provides to the patients around the world. I'm James Millward, also a PA and your host for Vital Minds. Today is our very first episode of Vital Minds. Our topic is obesity in America, and I'm excited to introduce our podcast first expert and guest, Larry Herman, PAC, MPA, and Distinguished Fellow of the AAPA. Larry is currently president of Palantir Healthcare, LLC, a healthcare consulting firm, but he's also a recently retired dean and professor in the College of Health Sciences at Gardner-Webb University in Boiling Springs, North Carolina. He practiced in emergency medicine for nearly a decade as chief PA in a busy New York City Level 1 trauma system, and then began practice in family medicine and was the administrative medical director for a very large multi-specialty practice. Additionally, Larry completed a five-year term on the board of directors for the American Academy of PAs, where he served as president and subsequently chair of the board of directors. Larry, I'm so glad you have joined us today for this discussion as we take a closer look at obesity in America.
Well, thanks, James. I am happy to be here. It's my pleasure.
According to CDC research, more than one-third of U.S. adults, approximately 36.5%, have obesity. The associated price tag is an estimated $147 billion for all obesity-related medical costs. With that in mind, tell me, Larry, what's on your mind about obesity in America?
Well, James, perhaps more than any other disease on the face of the planet, obesity and overweight, but obesity in particular, is ubiquitous. We are talking about 2 out of every 3 patients who walk into our offices who are either overweight or, frankly, obese. And the epidemic is not improving. In fact, it's getting worse. In a couple of decades, it's estimated that 50% of the American population will be, frankly, obese. And we've even reframed in our minds the way people look at weight. The new normal in people's minds would be overweight when they look at the body habitus of an individual with a BMI that qualifies as overweight. The individual looks at that person and now they consider that to be a normal weight. So it's even worse than that because we talk about $147 billion for all obesity-related medical costs. None of us feels that obesity is going to disappear overnight. We need to make small inroads gradually, the same way the country became overweight and obese over decades of time. But if we could reduce the BMI of the country by just 5% and stop and think, it's not precisely the same thing, but roughly speaking, we're talking about a 200-pound individual losing 10 pounds of weight. Roughly speaking, it's not exactly equivalent to that, of course, we all realize as clinicians. But that's a reasonable goal for somebody to lose that amount of weight. If the country lost that amount of weight, we would reduce the economic burden on the medical system by $610 billion over a 2-decade period. That's the amount of money the American government spends on our military for an entire year. So this is so common, so all-pervasive. We know that there are 236 diseases that are either caused by or exacerbated by obesity, that we have clear documentation that this is the case. So there is nothing that is more pervasive than this disease in this country right now.
Now, that's great information, Larry. Now, in spite of its prevalence, we still see that obesity can be a very sensitive subject for patients and for some PAs for that matter. What are your thoughts on its diagnosis and communicating this with our patients?
That's a great question, James. I liken this to talking to your patients, taking a sexual history. And there are some things that people are uncomfortable with. As an example, people may not want to talk about tobacco addiction and tobacco cessation. And there's considerable data that says the individual who's addicted to tobacco takes 7 to 9 attempts to quit smoking. Well, that same concept translates to overweight and obesity, but it's even worse because there's much more stigma associated with being overweight and or obese in this country. There's a considerable amount of fat shaming that goes on because people think, as I was trained many, many years ago, so over two decades ago, I was trained that people who are overweight or obese simply need to do one exercise, push themselves away from the table. And nothing could be further from the truth. 50% of overweight and obesity can be caused by genetics. And we see this, the most extreme form of this would be something like Willie Prater. But we have identified more than three dozen genetic alleles that are associated with increased weight and obesity in patient populations. And the other 50% is the environment. And we've had a whole host of things that have occurred over the last 20, 25 years that has conspired to cause an increased weight in our country. And it's not just the fact that we have an obesogenic environment. We have access to fast food. We have access to high-density, high-energy foods that are very palatable from places like McDonald's. But we also have less activity. Most of us sit at a desk. If you wear a pedometer and you say to yourself, well, I'm seeing patients all day, I think most of us would be surprised as to how few steps we actually take, because we are now sitting down typing an electronic health record. We have medications that we prescribe to our patients that are weight-inducing or weight-gaining, cardiovascular drugs, many of our diabetes drugs, certainly our behavioral health drugs. So it's a conspiracy, so to speak, that occurs. And then we find it difficult to talk to patients because we can't frame it quite the same way we can with other diseases, because patients are going to want to terminate the conversation. We've got to actually ask their permission to speak to them about a healthy weight for them. And it's frustrating for clinicians because we haven't had good tools in our armamentarium until relatively recently. So patients feel frustrated. They go on yo-yo diets. They gain weight. We gain weight as we age. There's good data to support that as well. Most people actually over the course of a decade will move into the next BMI category, meaning from a healthy weight to overweight and a decade later to obese, unless we do something about it. But patients may not want to talk about it, and they certainly don't want to talk about it using terms that are offensive. Unhealthy weight is a term that patients certainly even bristle at. So we've got to be educated in how to speak to patients, and we've got to realize that we won't necessarily do this at the first visit. It may take 5, 6, 7 questions of, is today a good day to talk to you about this? And it may not be. It may never be, but it will be with a percentage of our patients, and I think we have a moral and an ethical obligation to do that. We wouldn't ignore any other disease. Why would we ignore obesity as a disease?
All right, so we've established that we know obesity is becoming a major problem here in America. But you mentioned the tools that we as providers have. So let's look at the treatments, from diet and exercise to medical therapy and more invasive procedures. What kind of effective innovation are you seeing in the way we're treating obesity now?
So another great question. And first, we need to recognize that our patients fall into a bell-shaped curve. And by that, I mean some strategies and some treatments will work very effectively in patients, and those same strategies will be ineffective in other patient populations. So there is not a one-size-fits-all for each patient. It is highly patient-centric and specific. But every single guideline, including the guidelines that the American Academy of PAs developed, all begin with changes in diet and in exercise. And it is, to a certain degree, the amount of calories that you take in and the amount of energy that you expend. So that is the first basis, and frequently requires, commonly, almost universally requires, meeting with a dietitian, a CDE, or someone who has the skill set to be able to talk about what are appropriate diets. And every diet is going to be different. I'm a carnivore. And when I, not that I go on diets per se, when I make lifestyle changes, I have a tendency to eliminate carbohydrates and increase my proteins if I'm trying to maintain or lose weight. other people, the Mediterranean diet will be most successful. And in fact, that's the one I generally recommend to my patients. Some folks like Weight Watchers. Other folks like electronic apps, and certainly millennials. I use a Fitbit myself and try and get 15,000 steps a day. That's incredibly difficult for people, especially if they're busy and they're working two jobs. So it's very, very hard for people to be able to do that. But eating intelligently and exercising more is the first step. The second step, the FDA has a number of pharmaceutical products that are anti-obesity drugs. They are effective. There's no single drug that will work well with each and every patient. Each has a slightly different mechanism of action. But the bottom line is we can expect to see 5 to 10% or more weight loss consistently with these drugs in monotherapy. And although 5 to 10% may sound like it's not adequate, again, you get significant reductions in hemoglobin A1Cs. With a 5 to 10% reduction, you get significant reductions in blood pressure, lipid panels. You get changes in people's behavioral health in a positive way. Every disease, virtually every cancer on the planet is affected by that. Orthopedic injuries, as an example, for every pound that a patient loses, they will take off 5.24 pounds per square inch on their knees. So folks who may need knee replacements or arthroscopies may be able to now eliminate the need or at least delay the need for those kinds of surgeries. For folks who exceed a baseline overweight BMI, and basically what we're talking about is a BMI of 26 to 30, being overweight and obese above 30, we have the ability in patients who have failed pharmacotherapy, they have failed diet and exercise. We have a number of bariatric surgeries that are available. Most commonly and most effectively nowadays, it's utilized would be a sleeve gastrectomy. But we also have some endoscopic procedures, things that are ostensibly saline-filled balloons that would be inserted into the stomach endoscopically and would provide a feeling of satiety and something that can be then removed over a period of time endoscopically, so much less invasive. So we have an array of tools that are available. And again, when you have one obese patient, you've seen one obese patient. Everybody is different. It's got to be custom tailored for them, which is why PAs need to get comfortable with this. We are frequently the last person in the room with the patient, and it doesn't matter whether you are the orthopedic PA, the cardiovascular PA, or the family practice PA. You could be managing the patient, or you could be part of the team, and the last person leaving the room, and it frequently, the orthopedist is an example, or the cardiothoracic surgeon, may defer to the PA's expertise in this area, being trained as a generalist. So we all have this in our wheelhouse, and it's one of the reasons why AAPA has spent as much time focusing upon this, because it's something that we believe PAs should absolutely own and be the preeminent provider of care for our patients, because as we approach 70% of our patients, none of us can avoid seeing these kinds of patients, and we need to have the expertise.
Now, talk to us about some of the major complications you've encountered when diagnosing and treating obesity. And how do you overcome and address these issues?
Well, some of this I've mentioned already in terms of patients not being comfortable talking about it and clinicians not being comfortable. But what's very, very interesting is patients actually want to talk about this, and study after study report the same thing, and that is, and forgive me, these studies are with physicians, so I'm not intending to offend our audience by using that term, but the studies were specifically with physicians, so I do want to be clear on this. Patients, when asked, did your doctor talk to you about this, said, no, my doctor did not bring up overweight or obesity. And when you asked the physicians, they said, of course I did. When you went back and actually looked at recordings of the same patient encounters to see where the disconnect was, almost universally the discussion was simply this: you need to exercise more and eat better to lose weight. And that was the entire discussion. So the first part is to be able to actually open that discussion, as we've talked about. But the other issues are the fact that patients have no confidence and clinicians have no confidence necessarily in medications because neither one of them has the experience. These medications and these surgeries genuinely work. So there's no doubt that we have tools in our armamentarium that we can utilize once we become comfortable doing so.
Very good. Now, finally, for the PA students listening in, can you draw from your decades of experience and leave us with a single piece of advice?
Well, that's another great question. And the recommendation I have is twofold to students. Number one, you have the benefit of learning things that clinicians in the field today never learned. When I trained, we knew a little bit about a few of these hormones. We knew certainly about insulin. We knew about CCK. We did not know about ghrelin or leptin, adiponectin, protein YY, and a number of other hormones that we now recognize as being crucial in regulating appetite and energy homeostasis. So you are graduating with a skill set that exceeds that of your preceptor and your more experienced colleague. So the first thing you need to do is recognize that you have an expanded skill set. The second is that there's a vacuum in the treatment of obesity, and it's a perfect arena for a new graduate to gravitate to because you now have that broadened skill set. We have tools that were never available. You're able to function and speak to patients using things such as motivational interviewing, which you're trained on, but many older clinicians are not. And you should become and own the obesity arena. You should truly become the expert in that area because of all of these connections and advantages that you have compared to an older dinosaur such as myself.
Well, Larry, thank you so much for your thoughts and perspective on the issue of obesity in America and for sharing your expertise and advice for future generations of PAs.
James, my pleasure, and thanks for having me.
Today's episode of Vital Minds is supported by Eisai, Inc. Eisai, Inc. is a fully integrated pharmaceutical business with discovery, clinical, manufacturing, and marketing capabilities with a focus in oncology and neurology, including dementia-related and neurodegenerative diseases. For those of you listening in, feel free to swing by our website for a list of Larry's recommended resources on obesity. For that information and to find every episode of Vital Minds, we encourage you to visit pa-foundation.org. Until next time, I'm James Millward, and this is Vital Minds.